right. Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and I'm here with another fine studio audience. Some of my favorite people in the world. Welcome, guys. You're all veterans. This is not a first for any of you, so my promise to be gentle does not hold.
And we won't be gentle to you, Joe.
You're all here tonight because you're all old like I am.
I protest. I'm younger than the rest of you.
All right, whatever you say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times on this podcast, we talk about things that happened a long time ago. But there's a lot of interesting shit that happened in the church in the last 20 or 30 years. And we sometimes don't give it its due course, do we?
No.
We all kind of lived through the age of Satanism. It really wasn't an age of Satanism. It was an age that they thought it was happening. And some of us thought it sounded awesome and went looking for it and couldn't find it because it wasn't there.
Some of us are still afraid, John.
In the more words of Bill and Ted, we were so lied to by our album covers. So tonight, we've had some wonderful soup. Thank you, both of you, both the Jens here. And we've had a little bit of liquor.
And we'll have a little bit more.
and we're ready to tackle the subject of the Satanistic scare, the Satanism scare that rocked the entire country, actually, and took roost among a lot of fundamentalists. There's some fundamentalists today who still buy into this bullshit, but it hit the Mormons particularly hard in the 80s and early 90s. And we're going to discuss that tonight. Welcome. Thanks, guys.
Welcome.
So first of all, returning, Jen, I've got many, many compliments on your laugh in the podcast. How you laugh at everything I say.
I do tend to offer that. Glad to be here.
And this topic is so important that, a great friend of mine and a great fan of the podcast and a great supporter who's almost always silent, Ted, is here.
Hello.
And he's actually on the mic.
Hi, Ted.
Hello.
And then you guys had your own podcast on Voices, right?
Yeah.
James and Jen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
You both look great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, I'm just tickled pink that you're all here in basement, in the Velvet Lounge tonight.
And we all survived the satanic panic of the 80s.
And 90s.
So far, it's not over yet.
Satan is still alive and well and backwards masking everywhere.
Yes.
So, religion. When you want to motivate people to do things, you have to give them a reward or a punishment. But what if you could give them the ultimate reward anybody could imagine, or you could punish them with the ultimate punishment? Well, then you're going to really be able to motivate them if you actually get them to believe it, right? So it's one thing to offer them a bonus of a turkey at the end of the year, you know, if they work well. It's another thing to be able to 72 virgins for the rest of eternity. Those aren't even in the same category, right?
Right.
So, religion has a tendency to take all punishment and all reward and amp it all the way up. Well, when you're talking about the punishment side, these things tend to get kind of scary, for people who believe in it. And I think that the originators of this stuff always want to use that as a threat to get something else. But there's another segment of the population that will focus in on that, and it becomes very interesting to them. And they start to think about it a little bit too much, and voila, we have the Satanistic scares. Now, let's talk about Elvis Presley to start out. I think this whole thing, you know, do we go back to the Puritans? The Middle Ages, they were, you can read Dante's Inferno. They were obsessed with hell and hellfire and punishment and this, what happens if you don't obey the proper world order and these pictures of demons and all this sort of terrible stuff, which is it's always the worst thing that everybody can possibly manage. That's what hell is. What hell is just, what's the worst thing you can possibly think of? And that's what it is. But let's talk about Elvis Presley.
I think that to start the conversation, I think you make a good point that the afterlife and the scare of the repercussions of your behavior and sinning is one aspect of what we're talking about. But I think the satanic panic or the scare is religion talking about satanic possession and the behaviors that can occur in the life of the present. And that's, I think, fascinating to me, that we're not talking about repercussions of sinning. We're talking about the fact that Satan can come into you and cause you to sin in this life. It's not repercussions in the next.
That's absolutely
right.
It's
the present scare.
I frame the question as hell and damnation and these evils are this consequence of behavior. Because one of the things that religion is concerned about is behaving correctly in justice. But you're right. What happens is those stories, those myths start to creep into the present.
Right.
And it doesn't take long before you say, wow, according to the scriptures, this devil guy is really powerful. Which, ergo, he must be doing all sorts of terrible things right now. And what are those things? And how can we see those things?
And I think the fear portion of that, the ultimate punishment, is a lot more real to us than that reward. Because that ultimate punishment and that Satanism appears so much in popular culture all through from the 50s on. You know, we were making movies about demon possession and ghosts and goblins and things like that. So I think that's more real to us almost than that reward of the heaven. That seems more distant, but the fear and the Satan and the evil seems more present in our lives and more easy for us to understand.
Well, I like what you say about how it's more real because I read something years ago, and I don't remember who said it or what they were saying. They were arguing that the growth of, say, the horror genre in the West coincided with the demise of traditional religious belief. So you look at, you know, 1913 Scopes Monkey Trial or the 1920s, whenever that was. So really, you know, that puts an end to religion, except for fundamentalists and those were, we really can't buy into the traditional religious model anymore. So what happens is then you become very cut adrift on things like, do I survive my own death?
Yeah.
And did grandma survive her own death? And is there meaning beyond this? So what the argument is that horror movies are a secular version of this life goes on. That there is an afterlife, that there is Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees might be a terrible characters, but what they show is there is an afterlife. You survive death, right? So it's this perverse, and there's an actual argument, and when we talk about Satanism a little bit more here, it's always just a reversal and a perversion of religious ceremony. In other words, it does not exist without the religion that it's based on. It has no meaning outside of, you know, and a lot of it is based on Catholicism because that's such a predominant theme. Mm-hmm. And it has no meaning outside of that. Once you become an atheist, this is where Christians get all mixed up. Once you become an atheist, also Satanism has no meaning because you have the mass and you have the black mass. They're just sort of the same thing. You know, it's just, they're just sort of inverted.
And the idea of the evil and the satanic and the demonic, let's face it, is far more interesting. Nobody's
sexier,
very very
at least.
Few people are making movies about how cool it is in heaven.
Well, and that's a function of religion, right? Because religion is oftentimes to preserve social order. This idea of denial of the individual interest, of preservation of group dynamics, sacrifice of the self for the group, these positive things. But we're talking about sacrifice, denial. So if you're going to invert that, it's about getting it on, man. It's about hedonism, right?
It's about naked black masses, right? Makes for far more interesting movies.
I invite every listener to go out, stop the tape now, and go out and watch the documentary on the Church of Satan. It was filmed in the 60s.
Right.
It's available on Netflix from time to time. Let me see if I can find it. But there's this great scene. Well, first of all, there's two great things. There's this woman, she's got to be like 55, and she's sitting there smoking a cigarette, and her turn is next to lay on the altar as the naked. And she could just not give two. jokes about it. It's just the unsexiest thing that you would ever see. But the best part of the film, from Mormon expression perspective, is the missionary. You guys seen this thing? It's like 1969. It's like the Hyatt and Ashbury district, you know, where this church is. The missionaries track this place out while the camera crew is there. It's the best thing ever. And they're just these two little Idaho white boys. And it's just priceless. Go see this documentary and all of your fear of the satanic dark powers will just dissipate when you see the actual Church of Satan and see them in their Holocaust robes and chanting and the saggy titted woman on the altar.
I do have to agree on that point. The Church of Satan in everything I've read and seen, even researching for this podcast, it's like, wow, that's just a lot more boring than you think it would be. It's like the same f-ing politics as all of the other churches that you read about. But back to your previous point, though, the afterlife and the afterlife versus that, like Satan in the present. I think we should get back to your Elvis point and life after death.
Yeah, then. So let's talk about Elvis Presley.
Because I think I diverted you and we went on a long tangent there.
It was brilliant. Thank you.
We went from Elvis to Jason Voorhees.
Exactly.
We've got nowhere. We've got all the time in the world. We can take whatever path we want. So what Elvis did... of course, he wasn't the only one, but he's the personification of it, is he took this African-American post-slavery black culture from the South that had grown independent of the predominant white culture of the South and had very interesting elements, and he brought it to white America. And because he was this charismatic white kid, and especially, you got to remember, early Elvis, before like Vegas sort of rhinestone Elvis, had this clean cut edge, like from the waist up.
I was gonna say from the waist down, not so much, John.
But this was the seduction of Elvis, is he could bring this element that was to white America, which at the time was post-war. Was trying to pretend, if you want to understand the 50s, and I say over and over again, the 50s was the golden age of the Mormon church. If you want to understand that, it's trying to pretend that the horrors of World War I and World War II did not happen. Okay, so Elvis takes this black culture and he makes it palatable to America in a way that obviously, is ripe for mass consumption. But takes the establishment and scares the bloody hell out of them. Because they realize what's going on here. This culture that is vibrant and active and wonderful, but suppressed because of the racism, comes out. And there's not a straightforward way to say, don't consume this. Even though everybody knows, the joke that everybody knows and don't talk about is that rock and roll is all about sex, right? That's where the term comes from. You know, you can look at the etymology of the term rock and roll, and it's a euphemism for f***ing. So they're introducing into white bread America, this post-war America that really wants to pretend that there's not atrocity in the world, that horrors do not exist. That's what the 1950s are all about.
Right.
We're going to try to build our little boxes, and we're going to try to just pretend that everything is all right. But here is this subversive culture that the kids are going crazy for and they can't stop. They can't bottle up.
And I don't know if I would say subversive as much as it's in your face, yet taboo. So it's right there. Yet all of a sudden it's something that has been taboo. And now there is a white, gorgeous kid thrusting his hips only in your daughter's face.
That's an excellent point. It's only not kind subversive. Taboo. It's not subversive in that, you know, teenagers were having sex and doing all these things always.
Right.
Always. It was the idea that in the 1950s, somehow they were more pure and righteous is cold malarkey. It never happened. It was a pretended reality that, that television and everything else was perpetuating. And this was, rather than a subversion to the dominant culture, this was an awareness and a window into what was happening anyway.
And what is interesting about that time is that media, so records and television and radio, all of a sudden are accessible to the normal, you know, middle class American. And so what was considered taboo in a household that where you didn't talk about it unless you were a teenager in the car or not in the car and, you know, in the haystack with your boyfriend, all of a sudden, everyone can see that it's happening and people are exposed and the media takes it and runs with it, begins to define it.
Absolutely. So you go back in time to Salem and to the Puritans. And when social order, or at least the social order they want, breaks down, well, what is it? If we are ordained by God, if our cultures are ordained by God and it's not working, well, it can't be us, right? Because we're the righteous ones. It's got to be the devil, right? So we start burning right. witches, right? So the same thing happens in the 50s and 60s. This counterculture grows, and it gets out of control of this white bread power that wants to pretend that everything's okay, that we won the war, and now white people, yay, and we're on top and we're in charge, and that's going to happen. Well, that's not happening, and it's starting to show up over and over and over again. And I think we overblow the counterculture, the cultural revolution of the 1960s in a way that doesn't acknowledge that. I mean, the beat poets were all from the 50s and 40s, right?
Exactly.
The flappers in the 20s were doing all the things that we just openly acknowledged in the 60s. So what, it wasn't really a revolution of American culture. It was a throwing off of this ideal that was sort of forced onto American culture, but was never real. And so if we talk about our Puritans, what they wanted to do is demonify. Is that a word? Make demonic.
It is now.
Thank you. Everything that was going on. So you start seeing this cycle that starts picking up in the late 60s, especially, where music, just like everything else, you're trying to differentiate yourself. And music starts growing more and more flamboyant, more and more theatrical. So the early roots of rock and roll were very sort of simple, and that's what made it palatable. You know, three chords and the truth, right? And then you start going, and it gets more and more crazy, more and more theatrical. Well, if you have this message of this authoritarian figure that you're already sort of rebelling against, saying that the music is demonic, and you're trying to differentiate yourself, and sometimes that differentiation in all things comes from pushing to extremes, there's a natural tendency to start playing into the very model that was set up. And this is what starts happening in the late 60s. That right. music becomes more, and music, pop music has always goes on cycles of simplification versus getting very complicated, you know. So you start getting the end of the 70s is this very complicated sort of Rush, or, you know, all this stuff. And then you have punk born. And this happens over and over and over again. So you're at the end of the 60s, you're getting into this Led Zeppelin and these other bands start coming online. They start becoming more and more theatrical. And you have the birth of bands that are blatantly playing on this Satanism sort of idea.
I protest that we're calling Led Zeppelin theatrical, but let's just put that on record.
Wait. You don't call Led Zeppelin theatrical?
No. But
I mean, the
but copycats were.
they weren't as theatrical on stage, but the music was overblown and playing into mythology and J.R.R. Tolkien and these themes that would show up in their music that it was not singing about, you know, oh, baby, 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 you know.
God, I remember Led Zeppelin saying that exactly, actually, John. but I do agree that there was some Tolkien in there as well.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
And you have these ambiguous lyrics too, right?
In fact, no one said, oh, baby, 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 better than Led Zeppelin ever.
Squeeze my melon, baby. Or lemon. I'm sorry. It's not my melon. Got to get my genders right.
You have these ambiguous lyrics coming out too. And I remember in the 80s, I had a friend that was introduced me to Ronnie James Dio.
Yes.
And we'd listen to his lyrics and we'd say, I don't know what the f- that means. And I would say, you know what? Either he's a genius or he's inspired by the devil.
Ride the
so
tiger.
There's this idea of, wow, those are great lyrics, but I don't know what they mean. So they must be coming from somewhere. Zeppelin wrote Stairway to Heaven in 7 minutes. How could they have done that? Satan.
Well, and I remember I was listening to Terry Gross one time interviewing Robert Plant. Right. And oh, let me find the lyric from Stairway Heaven. The hedgehog in the hedgerow. What is it? And she said,
"There's
what?
A bustle in your hedgerow. Don't be alarmed now."
Yeah, she said, "What the hell does this even mean?" And Palmer was like, oh, "Who knows?" You know how many millions of like drunken high discussions has that lyric or couplet inspired? And it's just like. You listen to rock and roll. I know we're jumping to the end of the book. You listen to rock and roll, and these guys are morons. They're not any smarter than the rest of us. They just know how to play the guitar and groupies, and we give them so much credit, you know? I'm sorry. I'm about to get punched in the face by Ted.
Well, that's the section that gets played backwards.
Oh, is that back mask?
Yeah. It's just a sprinkling for the May Queen. That's, My Sweet Satan backwards, supposedly.
So this theater, and you start getting bands like Black Sabbath. And at this point, it's out of the closet, right? They are not pretending at all that they're, you know, like Led Zeppelin would argue, oh, well, it's not, you know, whatever. But Black Sabbath is clearly playing on the ideas of Satanism and the inverse of religion. You don't agree, Jen?
I absolutely agree on the Black Sabbath point. But don't let that turn you off to Black Sabbath, like greatest albums ever.
But there's a fundamental misunderstanding. And what's funny is the kids who are actually listening to the music know that this is all a joke. All right. One of the songs out there that probably if you took your list of the greatest satanic songs of all time would be Crazy Train by Black Sabbath. Right?
Okay.
I'm going to read you the lyrics. Yeah. At least the first verse.
Yeah.
I. No, I. All right. Crazy, but that's how it goes. Millions of people living as foes. Maybe it's not too late to learn how to love and forget how to hate. That's the lyrics of one of the most satanic songs that's ever been out there. What I'm saying is that the people who digested this stuff knew it's all a big joke. It's a play on the establishment. And what became funnier and funnier and funnier to people who were metal fans and people who were in this is the more and more the white bread took it serious.
I took it serious.
You, Ted.
I'll say, John, when it comes to music, so a little of my background, I grew up in the 1980s, not as a Mormon, but as a Jehovah's Witness. And the idea that Satan was alive and well and living in the United States was very, very real to Jehovah's Witnesses. And I grew up totally frightened of anything heavy metal. Until the late 80s when I'd kind of broken away from that church and a friend of mine had what he called at the time a makeout tape. I guess it's a mixtape of heavy metal ballads.
Oh.
And, you know, I was in the back seat on the way back from Great America, Six Flags with Donna. I won't say the last name.
Thank you.
With Donna. And I'm listening to all of these beautiful songs. And I asked him the next day, I said, well, who sings this? Well, that's Judas Priest. Well, you know, that's Kiss. And I'm like, well, Kiss is Knights in Satan's Service. You know, though that's this group or that. And so once I grew up totally afraid of those.
Right.
But once I stopped and listened to what they were saying, I realized it was all a show.
Uh huh.
But I read an interview with Ozzy Osbourne and I asked him what his most prized possession was. And he said it was the cross that my father made me out of wood when I first joined Black Sabbath. I still have it hanging above my bed today.
If you go back, I challenge listeners to go back and like YouTube, like early Judas Priest videos, and you'll be like, wait a minute, this is about gay leather fetish. This is not about Lucifer. You were totally had.
So the music perhaps wasn't about Lucifer to the kids that were listening to it and the musicians that were playing it. But I go back to my point that the media made it about Lucifer, and there was a scare that occurred because a movement was defined by the media based on music that was taboo and very much counter to popular culture at the time. And it went further than just music. So that's what we've been focusing on in our conversation. But from that, people's lives were very much impacted and destroyed by what was a very serious panic in America and other first world countries. And that varied between the 80s and 90s of where it was occurring. But the media and the courts, took it very seriously and defined it to be something that damaged a lot of people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And you mentioned sort of this feedback cycle. And we've been focusing on music because that's where the primary focus is. But it was also film and literature and other areas of popular culture. And it kept fueling and building on itself. It's a great study in software and in psychology. There's an early program called Ezra. That was supposedly a psychologist. And what this program would do is you type in a question and it would just feed back whatever you're saying to yourself. When you go watch movies like The Exorcist now, what you'll see is this feedback loop of this religious idealization just turned on its head and fed back into the culture. So what starts happening is these things start compounding on themselves and compounding on themselves and compounding on themselves, in a way that starts creating a hysteria. And where for years and years and years we'd had this movement of horror, but in the late 70s you start seeing this reality tinge to it. The Exorcist, the Amityville Horror, these ideas that this may not just be, you know, if you watch like an American Werewolf in London, everybody knows there's no such thing as werewolves, at least, you know, most people. But the idea that somebody might, your neighbors could sacrifice their babies is something that could really happen, right?
Yeah, the Exorcist is almost shot like it's a documentary.
It's a brilliant film. The Amityville Horror, too, because if you read up about it, how this is blown up out of absolutely nothing. Yeah. This study in mass hysteria and taking these things on, this is exactly what Jen, the point she's making. Unfortunately, these things stop being a joke, which sort of Black Sabbath was. And some people start taking it very seriously. So let's talk about Michelle Remembers.
Just as sort of a segue, I might say that you mentioned earlier that a lot of, when we were talking about Elvis, that a lot of what the younger generation is doing is more or less in rebellion of what the status quo is.
Yes.
And if you look, as we're coming into the 80s, evangelical Christianity is gaining popularity. You have Pat Robertson with the 700 Club. And,
yes.
And I remember all of these, many of them now defunct because of scandals, all of these Christian ministers that are getting on a TV presence, and they're gaining popularity.
No, it wasn't
as we're going into the 80s.
It wasn't just the satanic scare that the media was taking hold of, but that popular Christianity, you know, that pop culture Christianity was also taking hold.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're not part of the mainstream media, we see this happen over and over again, you can make a voice for yourself being a critic of the media. So Christian culture now being bumped out from being like the main thing that people do sort of becomes a counterculture in and of itself, yeah. Right? So it's taking what is mass consumed and it is creating this message. But because of the way people process Christianity, it creates this feedback loop. That's my point, where this message that they're saying pumps up the theater of the horror films and of the music and of the media and makes them consumable. So this stuff, 1970s, you see a lot of this, these over-the-top horror movies, you know, things like I Spit on Your Grave,
Rosemary's Baby.
yeah, there's these element of Satanism, this element of and by I spit on your grave, I'm referring to this element of sacrilege, of horror as a vehicle for just taking every taboo in culture and right. just throwing it out there.
Yep.
Blood, sex, violence, death, filth, just everything possible that, and creating that excitement around that taboo. And of course, because religion is one of the chief sources of taboo, it is such a prime source to go to. If you wanted to create Satanism and you're an atheist, you'd have a hell of a hard job. If you're Catholic, it's easy. You just start turning things upside down and inverting colors, and changing the point of hats and stuff. But atheists don't wear hats. So what do you do? All right. So
Mormons don't wear too many hats either, but you know, they have some stuff as well.
There's an unfortunate thing that happens that oftentimes history is the product of two movements colliding in a very unfortunate way. During the 80s, we have two very unfortunate movements. This sort of Satanistic scare that's coming up and rising. This focus on darkness as an opposition to light as Christianity defines it. And then the pseudo-psychological phenomena of recovered memories.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the perfect storm.
Yeah, it is.
So Michelle Remembers. Michelle Remembers is a book published in 1980?
80.
About a woman who is having some trouble in her life. This is supposedly a true story. And she goes to her psychiatrist.
No, it's actually her husband.
Yes. Oh, even better.
Her husband was a psychiatrist.
Ah, excellent. The book has been sort of debunked and argued about and that sort of stuff. But she starts going into these recovered memories. And it's the book is actually fascinating. It's not great literature, but it's interestingly written. In that she's going through these patterns and it sets up this satanic calendar of events. And so she's remembering these things as they happened to her as a little girl. And of course, children, we biologically have a soft spot for children, but she's describing these horrific, absolutely deplorable things happening to her as a child. And then in what she's recovering these memories of her parents joining a satanic cult. And her as a six-year-old girl, or however old she was, if you remember, observing these things, of being thrown into a pit of snakes and covered in blood and just all this sort of 70s horror sort of stuff. But the book is touted as her actual recovered memories. And in the end, she, like Lucifer, has this congress with all of his chief... What are they? Chief priests once every 12 years? I'm looking to you. Ted, you're our resident.
Ted is supposed to know the answer to this question.
Everyone's laughing, but I took that stuff seriously.
Satan's Congress.
The one thing I remember is that all the chief priests of Satan have the right middle finger cut off. And of course, we all know who's missing this right middle finger.
Yakuza. The Yakuza.
Oh, no, I was thinking of Grateful Dead. What was his name?
Jerry Garcia.
Jerry Garcia. So this book spawns other books, and I can't remember if it came first, but Go Ask Alice, I think came before. I think that was in the mm-hmm. 70s.
Right, Go Ask Alice was first, and then Jay's Journal. Yeah.
Go Ask Alice was this girl, and I don't know. I haven't read a lot of the debunking stuff on it. It could be. I read it years ago. This young girl, in the 60s, she's about 15 or so, runs off to San Francisco, head Ashbury, gets involved in the drugs, sex, and all that kind of stuff. She keeps a journal, and it was distributed to high school students for a long time as this is, you shouldn't get involved in drugs. Cause she eventually kills herself, or no, she overdoses. I don't know. It ends in her death. It's her journal. After that is Jay's Journal. And Jay's Journal is what we want to focus on a little bit.
That was the Mormon lover.
Jay's Journal is a response to Go Ask Alice, and it's this journal, and of this kid named Jay, but instead of drugs as the predominant force, he gets involved in Satanism, and in the end of the book, he kills himself. And this book was widely distributed as a call to avoid Satanism. Now, I recently read the book in preparation of the podcast.
As did I, John.
because we don't have a lot of time to focus on it, In the opinion of your beloved moderator, the first half of the book and the second half of the book were not written by the same person.
No.
That proves it's true.
Chiasmus. Yeah,
one guy couldn't do it. It couldn't be one guy.
Couldn't be one 14-year-old kid.
Oh. I'll pipe in here and on the debunking stuff if you haven't read too much of it. There's very few pages in the 200 plus page book that were actually excerpts from Jay's journal. And so there was sadly a child named Jay or whoever his name, you know, whatever his name was in Utah that, did commit suicide and had a very hard time in adolescence. But, there are very few excerpts in the book, by Sparks. Is that
Beatrice
Sparks? That were, she fabricated the rest of the book. Unfortunately, a sad child's story was turned into a propaganda used by, people to scare children away from Satanism. But
this pious deception.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't read any of the counter argument. I picked the book up cold.
Right.
And read it. And it's clear. And I am no literary, like, scientist. It's just absolutely clear the writing styles shift. You see a troubled kid. There's elements of his journal that sound like a troubled 15-year-old.
Absolutely.
He's obviously intelligent, but struggling with sense of self-esteem and self-worth and a little bit of alcohol and, you know, getting in trouble. But it's interesting from a Mormon perspective to see that idea that he is a divine, special person with a special mission and he's fucking that up and how that messes with him. But when you get into the end, when it starts adding into the satanic stuff, it's just weird. It's not in the same style and like the vocabulary changes and what?
No, I agree. I mean, when I was reading it, I remember lying in bed and just telling Ted, like, are you serious? Like, why are you having me read this book? Because it wasn't real at all. But then I'm an adult now and, you know, you 30 plus years and I can't imagine reading that as 13, 14, 15-year-old in the 80s or whenever that was published. I didn't have the opportunity to read it when I was that age. And I can imagine how the way Mormons frame everything as the gateway drug to hell and eternal damnation. I can imagine reading that and not being frightened for my life,
well,
for
the
my
whole
soul.
Intent. The book was entirely written to frighten children.
It's a cautionary tale.
Now, you read it as a kid.
Yeah. I read it when I was 16. It sat on my bookcase next to...
Now, for reference, how old are you, Ted?
I'm 45.
45.
So I lost
you're
track.
16. You're right in the sweet spot. This is around 1980.
This is in the 80s. I was in high school. I read it. And I also read Jim Carroll, Basketball Diaries, Life on the Streets of New York.
Which is a real story young adolescent his heroin addiction at age 13, for Christ's sake.
But I gave both books the same amount of credibility. Oh,
Did you read it, Jen? Did you read it?
You have the luxury of saying that's ridiculous at your age, because you
that's what I'm saying. It's a, it's a tragedy.
Then,
yeah. Back then, it was terrifying. I mean, I was also growing up in the 80s, living in Utah Valley, where all of it happened. So it was
like you and your friends went to the grave.
Everybody would go, you'd go there with groups of kids in the canyons. There were always little rituals and cults going on. When I was at that same time walking through the canyons, near my house, I came across a baby deer that had died and its eyes were out and its tongue was out. And it's probably, you know, just the maggots ate there first. But in my mind, it was a Satan cult had happened there and they sacrificed this deer and took the heart out and the eyes out. And it terrified me as a kid.
Because I want to be clear for people who are growing up in the church today. For those of us who grew up during the 80s, 70s, 80s, this is the height of the Cold War. and the world was just about to
service at this time.
And the church used this to keep us all in a state of just absolute fear. Because, you know, when my parents went to school, it was duck and cover. And with us, it was like, you're fucking blown.
Yeah,
I mean, don't. It's
game
gone,
no man. Chance.
And you can see it in the media. You know, watch Rocky III or Red Dawn or these movies that just this fear that the end was near. And this that Satan and his power was growing and growing and growing, and this stuff was real. And like you're talking about, Jen, that anything that was out there, would be seen as sign this is all happening. So let's talk about the scare that starts happening in the 80s all over the country. This is not just a Mormon phenomenon.
And
she was Catholic. This was not a Mormon thing at all.
No, and the Mormon thing even came just a little later. I mean, they're behind the times as usual. just a little slow.
So
not just
up,
in fashion.
I'm sorry. Growing up as a Jehovah's Witness, we, like I said earlier, we had that scare. And I remember sitting in a meeting, you know, either a Thursday night, we went to church two times a week or three times a week, sitting in a meeting when somebody announced from the stand or the pulpit rather that Smurfs were satanic. And now a lot of people laugh, but you can Google this. And Jehovah's Witnesses, we actually believed at one point in the 80s that Smurfs were satanic. And they said, well, Smurf in German means little devil. And my dad, who's German and should have known better, brought us home that night, had us gather up all of our Smurf toys, took a knife and cut the heads off the toys and burned them. And, you know, sitting in
which is probably more satanic than Smurfs, really, you know.
It scared, both of it scared the hell out of us when we were kids. There's stories of people who wore a Smurf necklace to church and the Smurf, you know, during the prayer came alive and jumped off the necklace and ran out of the kingdom hall. And we believed it. And you hear stories from the stand of people that go to garage sales and they say, be careful what you buy, because I bought, you know, I knew somebody who bought a table at a garage sale and it was possessed. And then, you know, their house became possessed. And there was this idea that even inanimate objects could be possessed by the devil. And so growing up, we lived in abject fear, not of God, but of Satan.
And for those of you right now chuckling, I have two words for you. Ouija board.
Ouija board. So right? True.
That most of you, I would dare say, still have this harbored feeling that this inanimate object, a Ouija board I was going to swear. I'm trying to be better.
You're surrounded by those.
It's a printed alphabet with a little stylus. That's all it is, right?
Right.
But the idea this is somehow, do you guys remember the story from like when you were a deacon, they'd say, yeah, and they were playing with a Ouija board and this deacon walked in the room and it stopped working because he had the priesthood. Yeah. I tried a Ouija board. What a disappointment after all that build-up. It's cardboard. I was like, I'm going to make a spell dirty words. It doesn't even work that well. It doesn't work at all. What a ripoff. I want my money back.
I think it worked for those who believed it. My mom has stories from the 50s of playing with a Ouija board.
Of course, because it's part of this build-up. So during the 80s, this goes into overdrive. So I mentioned the recovered memories. Recovered memories are very important.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have actual evidence for something, eyewitness accounts are so emotionally compelling, but scientifically so devoid of any value. And we've talked about many of the books that prove this. Michael Shermer's Why People Believe Weird Things has a whole chapter dedicated to what we're talking about, the Satanistic scare. Mistakes were made, but not by me. Talks about self-justification and some of these elements. And this has been routinely and over again proven to be not true. But the way we evolved, we trust testimony so much more than outside evidence that allows for these cycles to start happening. Because so many people will tell you stories about these things happening. And it's always happening to somebody close to them. My nephew's sister, you know, they actually had, I remember, I was a senior, so 1991, my English class, the English teacher, who wasn't LDS or wasn't active LDS, had a social worker, he was a Christian social worker, come in and tell us stories about going into these houses where people were possessed and people being thrown against the wall. And this is an English class in a high school. And just that the idea that the devil was out there and playing havoc with the system and just behind the scenes, you know, was very prevalent.
So I think you bring up an important point, John, about the entire satanic panic or the scare that we're talking about, and that and the vulnerable folks that are really the victims in the entire thing were the children who were convinced that they were not remembering the abuse. So much of the satanic panic of the 80s revolved around satanic abuse of children by adults, and the psychology behind those interviews and the testimony that was planted basically in these kids' heads, you know, convincing children that something happened to them that did not happen. It was a huge part of why the media grabbed onto it. You can't not report, you know, on this group of children that have been abused in some sort of satanic ritual, or you know. So I think a huge part of why it gained hold, you know, and took hold in the popular media was because of the psychology of these memories that children were repressing or forgetting that ended up being false, you know.
I have had in my career about 10 major disagreements with the ex-Mormon community. And one of them has to do with that steaming pile of shit book written by Martha Beck. accusing her father of donning Egyptian. No, I really, there are ex-Mormons who hate me for this. I will get hate mail. Donning this Egyptian stuff and then ritualistically abusing her. All through recovered memories.
Sure.
And it's just flat out ridiculous. And I would invite anybody first to Google Martha Beck's husband's response to the book. Cause he gets named in the book and some things, and he comes out and says, this is all just bullshit. But it falls into this thing that there are some really great principles of that we have about victims, and victims are, by definition, a victim of power, right? They're on the bed. So there's a response to say we can't further victimize the victims by not acknowledging their pain. So when somebody comes up and says, I was ritualistically sexually abused and it was very traumatic for me, you don't say, ah, bullshit. You're full of it. I mean, your response is to say, oh my God, you know, and kind of give them a step back.
Particularly if they're 6 or 7 years old.
Well, and you look at the transcripts now of some of these, and you guys saw like 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, one of the early cases, one of the women who was locked up after 20 something years in prison was just released. They finally overturned the case. So during the 80s, this was happening that, nursery school providers, priests, parents were all being thrown in jail on this recovered memory. And you look at some of the transcripts and they look like this. Did your teacher touch you? No. Did they touch you on your belly? No. My teacher didn't touch me. Did your teacher touch you on your hand? No. And they keep badgering these kids over and over and over again. And then the 6-year-olds, after hours of interrogation, eventually break down. And we've shown psychologically it's very, very easy to implant memories into these kids.
And maybe this is a good time to talk about what really started to give steam to this satanic panic.
Okay.
Was in 1983 with the McMartin preschool.
Yeah.
Trial.
Okay. So let's
Michelle Smith, who, you know, from Michelle Remembers, actually took part in either testifying or supporting the parents at this trial. And so
And if you look at the transcripts now or the story, mm-hmm. it's this crazy, crazy accusation of all these weird, weird things. And a lot of the reaction was, this is just too bizarre to not be true.
Right.
Right?
That was, that, right. Right. But it did start, but that's what's interesting about the media and the way that pop culture panic can spread. It did start with one parent's accusation.
Of sexual abuse.
One parent's accusation of sexual abuse. And, and then the social worker, that worked these kids for their testimony. I mean, it gained steam. It was during all this other stuff that we're talking about, but the social worker that was working the testimony of these many children was using a form of interrogation for these young children with dolls that was incredibly leading that would never hold up in court. Right.
Well, and the base assumption for recovered memories is, how do you know if you have repressed memories? Because you can't remember them. It sounds so ridiculous to say out loud, but that is the basic assumption. So they would talk about, if you read, and it's in the PACE memo we'll talk about and other things they talk about, disassociation a lot. They say this is evidence. Right. The fact that you can't remember what happened to you during the summer, the year you were four, well, that's clear evidence that something happened that you disassociated from. So it became this, scientifically, it becomes this theorem that has no way to disprove it. Mm-hmm. All paths. So if you remember ritualistic abuse, it happened. If you don't remember it, well, it happened.
Right.
Right. Because you've just suppressed the memory.
But I think the McMartin case brought that into mainstream psychology. As Jen said, they were getting these anatomically correct dolls. And it went from, okay, I've been touched inappropriately by my daycare provider to they're sacrificing rabbits in the daycare and telling us that that's what they're going to do to our family if we report this. And they're taking place on all these blood rituals. And it's interesting to note that this daycare was on a very busy street in either Sunnyside or Sunnydale, California, and the entire front of the daycare was windows.
Right.
So anybody walking or riding the street could see what was going on here, but that didn't matter as much as the evidence that the psychiatrists had come up with. And that was the first time they started dealing with SRA or satanic ritual abuse in a psychological manner. And
Okay. So we've been flirting with satanic ritual abuse. Mm-hmm. So we talked about this culture of Satanism that grew out of the '70s. The idea that started creeping in was that there were these underground satanic covens. And what they were doing was practicing witchcraft or black magic or whatever. And then as the stories grew, they went to the ultimate evil. They were killing and babies.
They were killing kids, for sure.
Right.
Eating babies, sacrificing babies.
So these stories would grow and grow and grow, and it was this black menace all the time that was creeping underneath. And the idea came first that there were these people who would go out in the canyons or wherever and do it. And then the idea grew stronger and stronger that there were whole wards that were practicing this in secret.
It a huge conspiracy theory. In the media, it became a sort of, what do you call it? Illuminati or, it was the wealthy.
The government.
That class of folks were all involved in this secret society of satanic ritual and child abuse and sacrificial killings of babies and animals and the works. And I mean, that's where, and the Mormons grabbed onto that in the late 80s, 90s, which was interesting.
Right. So.
Jumping ahead.
This was an American phenomenon, this culture, this idea that's happening. And the stories keep getting better and better and better and better in the media. And as, you know, to once again jump ahead to the end, Michael Shermer states that there has never been any physical evidence found ever that any baby has ever been murdered or whatever. And so the stories have to get elaborate. So, because, if you're sacrificing babies, well, where are the missing babies? oh, well, they're impregnating teenagers and keeping them in prison in the basement so they can have babies so that we can go. And then the story gets better and better and better to explain why there's no evidence. It's a standard conspiracy thing, theory thing. You have to keep wrapping more and more layers around your conspiracy to make it work, which leads us to the point where you start to assume that it's systematic throughout all the church.
Yet the sad thing, and I think the interesting thing about the 80s and 90s is that people went to jail. So we're talking about the Martin trials. I mean, according to Ted and Pipin, if one of the most expensive cases in United States history, or the Memphis Three,
West Memphis Three.
We're talking about cases that impacted so many people's lives right. for so long. It wasn't just hysteria. We were putting people in prison because churches, courts, police, daycare providers were all saying the same false stories about abuse and about satanic ritual, and there's no evidence.
Right. And you also have these trials with McMartin and the West Memphis Three, where they're having expert testimony from experts on religion and the occult.
Which is a first as well, right.
Instead of introducing evidence, we have with West Memphis Three, particularly, I remember seeing this in a documentary where this guy that's an expert on occult was testifying how, well, these kids were dressed this way and
they listened to this music.
And
back to our original
children
point,
were found
right.
mutilated in this stream, and the marks of their mutilation resemble satanic cults. And you know, it's since been proven that there was these turtles in the stream that would snap at anything that was floating in the stream.
Right.
But we all of a sudden we're going all the way back to the 16th and 17th century. When we have these witch trials and we have people that are experts on religion and witches in the occult testifying in criminal trials.
Yes, it's a perversion. This whole thing is a perversion of the scientific system because, yeah, you have experts on things that don't exist. How can you disprove expert, like I'm an expert
exactly.
on witchcraft?
Exactly.
Right. You know, it's like, well, and then it becomes, well, he's an expert, right? He's got a PhD in what was his PhD in? And it just starts building and building and building.
And at the same time, we've got the court cases, on television. We've got the talk show hosts of the time, you know, of the era, like Rivera making specials, you know, huge, long, like 3 day, eight time. I don't know. I mean, I was a little young, but I remember Rivera and how big he was. Talking about satanic rituals and millions of people involved in satanic worship and ritual and it was a huge affront to the Church of Satan who I mean, these are real people that are a much smaller population than what we're talking about.
They must have been like in committee meetings saying, why can't we get any funding? There's so sweet millions of us, man. Millions and millions.
Exactly.
Well, it's hard. You know, we talk about fear. I just, how scared I was of the end of the world. Mm-hmm. The other day I was driving from school and he asked me, what's the second coming? And I started laughing. I'm like, well, we have to talk about the first coming. Yeah. You know, and it's just how, at his age, how scary yeah. that was.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Because my kids, movies on Satan and yeah. devils and demons like, don't scare them one bit. Serial killers, yes.
I love these old movies from the 60s and 70s about Satanism. They're yeah. just brilliant, especially the pornographic ones.
Yeah, Rosemary's. Oh, even the ones they did with, you know, with Christopher Lee did with the Edgar Allan Poe movies, Hitting the Pendulum or House of Usher, they were all satanic.
Okay, let me just say with the McMartin trial and the West Memphis 3, thank you. Now, when we watch the documentary and we're talking about how ridiculous it is that they brought in all of these, you know, experts, back then, I 100% believed all the stories. I believed that all those kids were sexually abused. I believed that those three killed those little boys. also real and scary.
I shudder to think that I would have been on a jury.
Oh, yeah.
On the McMartin trial when I was younger. Because I would have.
Yeah. I would have
condemned people to years in prison.
Absolutely. Think about something as simple as a razor blade and apple. You all know what that is. We were schooled about it over and over again. It's never happened in the history of the world. No one has ever slipped a razor blade into an apple and given it to a child. But we sure as hell spent a lot of time talking about it and worrying about
it. Tearing
our Halloween candy apart.
Yeah, checking the Halloween candy.
because as an authority figure, the fear that something like this is going on and you're not responding properly. It's the same thing that happened with Bush's, his color codes for threat level.
Yeah, absolutely.
The problem with the system was no one politically had the balls to ever lower the threat level. Because if you're a politician and you say, lower it from orange to blue or whatever the hell the color was, and something happens, well, you're exposed. So it just went up and up and up till it sat at orange and then it disappeared. And this is the same thing that leads us to the Glenn Pace memo.
I do want to say, John, before you transition to the Pace memo, that you say that no one had the balls to defuse it. And I mentioned Rivera and his television show and
Geraldo.
Geraldo. Exactly. I guess he's better known as Geraldo than Rivera. But he did apologize, later for his satanic ritual, television specials. And it may have been 90 seconds or 120 seconds or however long his apology was, but he did come back and say, I was wrong. And there's very few people with his sort of influence at that day and age that dare do that. And I want to give a nod, I guess, to that, and it probably made some impact with some folks that he came back and said, you know what? When I stated, you know, that data, it was wrong. I was dead wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. This has all been debunked. Only conspiracy theorists believe this stuff today.
Right. But the Pace memo was still interesting. So let's go back to that.
Pace memo was interesting. So Glenn L. Pace at the time, and there is a lot of belief that he eventually lost his position over this.
Right.
Because they had to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Glenn L. Pace was the presiding bishop of the church at the time. This is 1990. And he was writing a memo to the church black ops department, strengthening church members committee.
Right. Community.
Committee still exists today. Their job is to track people. So if you're a Mormon and you are quoted in auspice of the church in the New York Times or in the Salt Lake Tribune or whatever, they will clip the article and start a file on you. So what they are a tracking service for the brethren to track everybody in the church who is an agitator. This is well known. It's probably a topic all in its own. I've come to the conclusion after doing this podcast for coming up on 5 years now and for being around that they are not to be feared. They're the most inept, bureaucratic organization in the world because that's the only explanation. don't fear the Reaper.
And this is who's so as the non-Mormon Mormon of the group, and it's Benson. Who's prophet when we're doing this commute?
1990 would be Benson, but Benson is incapacitated at the time.
Okay.
So Hinckley and Monson are effectively running the church behind the scenes.
Okay.
We'll skip ahead a couple of paragraphs to understand what he's talking about. He talks about interviewing 60 individuals. This is the presiding bishop.
Right.
So these are you can imagine this groundswell organization going up through stake presidents, getting with other stake presidents, talking to air authorities, eventually getting all the way up to the attention of the presiding bishop and getting 60 individuals in the church for this guy to talk to firsthand. He reports he interviewed all these 60 people himself. This is a quote. Of the 60 victims who I have met, 53 are females and 7 are males, 8 are children. The abuse occurred in the following places: Utah, 37, Idaho, 3, California, 4, Mexico, 2, and other places, 14. 53 victims are currently living in the state of Utah. All 60 individuals are members of the church. 45 victims allegedly witnessed and or participated in human sacrifice. The majority were abused by relatives, often their parents, all developed psychological problems. He goes on to say they live normal lives, but their memories are locked up in a compartment in their minds and surface in various ways. They don't know how to cope with it. Then he goes on, this is key. There are two reasons why adults can remember with such detail events that happened in their past. First, the terror they experienced was so stark it was indelibly placed in their mind. Secondly, the memory is compartmentalized in a certain portion of their mind and was not subject to the dilution of experience of ensuing years. This is one of the reasons skeptics attack these things, is because they will describe these things in stark, stark detail that is different from the way normal people remember things.
Right.
Which indicates that it's fiction.
Exactly.
And once again, we go to the Shermer point, which is 53 of these people saw human sacrifice. Where are the bodies?
And where is the money? Didn't they spend some money on researching? In Utah, didn't they spend some money researching the Pace Memorandum?
To the tune of
like $300,000 or something. They spent some money researching the allegations from the church in the state of Utah.
Yeah, and it was determined to be of no merit.
Of no merit. They could not find any merit.
The only evidence for almost all of this stuff is people just telling stories, which is not evidence whatsoever.
We don't even have any blood-covered altars anywhere.
No, not outside an Ozzy Osbourne concert.
Or Jenny Torture. Yeah. Or one of them.
But Ozzy seems so benign to me now. Compared to, you know, in the 80s when I was afraid of the man.
Well, first of all, you can't understand a word he's saying. Secondly, I mean, the last decade gave us exposure to these people and saw who they are, yeah. Which is shrewd business people. You know, when you look at Kim Kardashian and peel below the surface, what you see here is a shrewd businesswoman, someone who does not do stupid things. She knows what she's doing and she has a nice ass. And those two things come together and she's able to create a career out of it. When you listen to Sharon and Ozzy talk, you know that these are calculating sounds too bad. These are people who know what they're doing. It's theater. Yeah, they're playing to a message. And Jimmy Swagger is probably as much to blame for all this as Ozzy Osbourne is, because they create the environment in which teenagers who feel separated or disassociated from the culture can go for a place to consume this. But they consume it by sitting in a room and masturbating furiously and listening to this music with their black lights on. They don't sacrifice children.
They don't. So I'm interested, and this is somewhat off topic, I suppose, because I left the church young, I'm interested in knowing, if in the 80s and early 90s, right when I left, then there's this aspect of Satan and the panic and the possession factor and what he or they can make you do in your life. So after that wanes and the Mormon kids, that there's no satanic panic anymore. Now, what is Satan's place in the Mormon church? In the Catholic Church, in Christianity as a whole, how in 2013 can they leverage that?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think Satan in the history of religion sort of becomes more concrete than less concrete, becomes an abstraction. Yeah. So today it's all about pornography and social media and rated R movies and Satan. There's this idea still that Satan is influencing everything. That if you go see Full Metal Jacket, Satan somehow gets your mind. And it's that message in the temple. If you don't do everything that we, the brethren, tell you to do, you're in Satan's power. So there's this constant sort of, it's out there somewhere. It's the end of every horror movie where you seem to vanquish the devil. You seem to take this place memo and saying, and you blow Kay's cross up and you do that sort of thing and you make it go away. And then it's just, it's out there waiting to reform in episode 6.
And I think on smaller levels too, it still is alive like it was back then. Just on small scales, our daughter wanted to play with a Ouija board. We brought that up earlier. And she had one of her friends that was terrified, begging her, do not play with a Ouija board, because obviously in his home, that's still, devil's going to come in. And
well, and in the 60s, you would find Mormons who would say the same thing about face cards, right? It's sort of like the tide rising, and then it descends. Like Ouija board is the extent over here. And then there'll be these things in between that come and go.
But it seems like Satan now doesn't have as much of a hands-on role in misleading people as he did in the 80s. Now you hear about the tools of Satan. Right. Pornography is a tool of Satan. Mm-hmm. This is a tool of Satan. And if you look throughout history, Satan is constantly, as you said, resurfacing. If you look at 30 AD, there was this idea that the Christians had that the Jews were kidnapping their children. That Jewish people were kidnapping Christian children and using them in sacrifices and using the blood to make wine and matzah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that dies down, and then it resurfaces another time. It resurfaces in Salem, Massachusetts as witch hunts. It resurfaces in McCarthyism. We always need that enemy, and that enemy is constantly resurfacing and becoming stronger and stronger. And Christianity will string that out until the end of time, you know, just to keep their ruse going.
Yeah.
They need Satan.
I think these things never go away. You will find elements of the church, the conservative elements, who still believe all this is absolutely true. And they'll say the fact that the Pace memo was dismissed, and that even though it went all the way to the top of the church, And people in high positions believed all this was going on. It was disproved. It's just further evidence that Satan is running the world, right?
Yeah.
That Satan covered his own tracks up. So those tapes, which we listened to, you know, this is before the internet. So there were these firesides we listened to in the '80s. They were great. They would tell you which album we would use this to go find the records. And so most record players that we had didn't have. So, kids.
What's a record player, John?
In the olden days, there were these black discs with a needle, and we called them an LP for long play, as opposed to a 45, right? Or a 78, or whatever the hell they were. And most record players didn't have a backward setting. So what you do is you take your finger and you would rotate the record backwards to try to get the stuff. But there were these tapes that were going around, these firesides. So the way we got information back then is we had firesides, and then they record them in Selma Desert Book. And I looked a little while ago to find one of these ones that was going around. They would tell you all these, you know, like they would talk about how satanic we reference this, like Stairway to Heaven was. The real thing about Stairway to Heaven, it was long enough that you could get a good grope in on a dance floor, right? That's why Stairway to Heaven was so popular.
Been there.
So we would go back and use it as a roadmap to say, what? If you play Billy Squire's album backwards, you hear smoking marijuana. All right, well, I'm gonna try that out. And that's it perpetuated up. But my point is that those tapes are still listened to by the conservatives. They won't go away. There's still people who believe there are witches. They'll look at Salem witch trials as evidence that there were witches, and it was just a time they surfaced, and then they went away. So the problem is these things never, they just go dormant for a while. You can't ever totally wipe out a virus.
Right. I've often wondered in the ex-Mormon community why I feel alone as someone that was so frightened by the devil. I mean, I've met a lot of ex-Mormons. Not a lot of them express the same kind of fear that I experienced as a child. And I came to the conclusion that probably people that were as scared as I was of the devil as a child are still afraid of the devil. And did not leave the church.
or are leaving late in life, as some folks are.
So there you have it. The Satanistic scare was real. It seemed like this bizarre blip in history, but it actually happened. And people took it really seriously. And we've had this whole conversation with a lot of laughter, because in retrospect, it seems so bizarre and something the church would just wish would go away. But these things creep up again and again and again. And I'm sure in the future, people will look at the discussions the church has with, you know, sleeve length on dresses and stuff. You know, what's funny about religion is it's very rare for us to go and blink, you know, those religious guys from 300 years ago, they were really right about this thing. Like, that just doesn't happen.
Damn, why didn't I listen to that guy?
Those guys really had it together. Why didn't we listen to them? And that's typically not how it goes. Religion's been on a 10,000-year losing war with reason.
Yeah, we're in the valley.
The valley.
The low valley.
But it speaks to the danger. This is why these things, you know, because a lot of people will say, hey, you know, religion, it's just mostly harmless. The church is about doing home teaching, giving bread to people. But that for the most part, that's true. I acknowledge that point, that most people do not experience these things. But it gives the platform for these things to grow. And this is the point that, say, Krakauer was making under the banner Heaven Bath Laffertys. Not, right, as some ex-Mormons misunderstand, that Mormonism caused the Laffertys to do their ferocious crimes. It just gave a platform and a venue. And when you watch horror movies, almost the entire genre does not exist without Catholicism. And it's not that Catholicism causes it. It just gives this story platform for it to happen. And the reason that people talk about sacrificing babies is because religion has a concept of sacrificing innocent people. And once they give up on that idea, it won't show up anymore. It's you guys. I said before, the atheists don't wear hats and they don't sacrifice people. That idea does not occur to us. You have to be religious to even fathom such an atrocity.
Roger that, John Larson.
Well, all right. Any last thoughts? You know, I will say, but we were communicating about this before we got together, and at the end of the last conversation, we selected the date. Ted typed "Hail Satan" at the end of the conversation. I will admit that I hesitated for 3 beats before I returned "Hail Satan" back to him, because even though these things, I put that as a final, that these symbols, these cultural memes that show up, that people play with in this music, in this theater, are very, very powerful. They very speak to us, and that's why these things happen, and that's why religion works. So anyway,
or doesn't have to.
John. Hail Satan!
Yeah, hail Satan!
All right. As always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com, and as long as we haven't been hacked by Kostanians or whatever this particular month, you should be able to access this and the back archive. Ted, Jen, James, it's been a true pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Come back anytime.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.